13. Of the rain and the figure of death. The rain started almost as soon as they went out the Port Saint-Bernard and left Paris behind. The girl thinking of the tale of Lot's wife, telling herself not to look back at the dying city, and then doing it anyway. A column of smoke above Paris bade them farewell, as another column of smoke had once greeted them. This one, however, was in the city, where the fire at the woodcarvers would burn his whole block, sending the healthy into the streets, consuming the sick and the dead. The drops of cold rain that fell on Delphine's face were the vanguard of the deluge that would save the left bank from burning, but flood the marshy land on the right bank all the way to the Place de Grève. Bells tolled in the Latin Quarter. There were enough hands, at least, to pull a rope or two. Delphine tried to picture the people ringing those bells. A lone Dominican monk or a paid ringer for the convent. Another priest like Père Mathieu, too scared to minister to his flock, but trying to save what was left of his soul by warning them about fire. Or were the dead ringing their own bells? If statues could walk, why not them? She felt more tears coming for Annette, and also for herself. When would she feel a woman's love again? Had Annette died because Delphine had wanted to stay with her? The words of the wicked statues rang in her head again, and she looked at the men in the front of the cart.
Please don't let them die because of me, God.
And now the rain fell, and fell, and fell. On the third day of it, and their second day without food, the priest saw a stone barn and a cottage and hoped they would be deserted. What had things come to when a man of God wished misfortune on a family because he coveted their roof? The door to the cottage was open, but they made for the barn, as they would have more room for the mule, and none of them were in the mood to find bodies. The barn was not deserted. The priest walked in first and found a naked man on all fours, stuffing hay into his mouth. An abundance of hay and grasses were knotted into his white beard and hair. His ribs were showing, and he was grimed over and wet, whether with rain or the sweat of some fever was unclear. His eyes were wild, though, and he was not frail. He picked up a rusty scythe with a broken shaft from a pile of farming tools and started toward the priest.
Good God, he means to eat me.
Then Thomas and Delphine walked in. Thomas with his sword unsheathed, and the man bolted out the other door, falling when the edge of the scythe clipped the doorframe and slipped from his hand, but scampering to his feet again almost instantly. He ran straight across the puddled field and kept running, his bare feet kicking up water all the way, disappearing not in the direction of the house, but toward the tree line past the field. Thomas broke the silence that followed by saying,
"So, that's what the Reaper looks like without his robes."
The priest laughed after a pause. But the girl just blinked rain out of her eyes and looked at them for an explanation.
"Death, girl, death,"
said the priest. Now she laughed too, and the sound of it was good in the barn. They built a fire and took off as many of their clothes as decency allowed, hanging these on sticks to dry. When they had, they changed out their underlinens and then hung them, putting the cozy, dry ones back on, glad for once not to be cold and soaked. The weather had changed, and where the days had been warm and the nights cool, now the days were cool and the nights cold. They agreed to stay in the barn until morning, then scout the fields for fruit or nut trees, or whatever they could find. In the meantime, they set out their cups and bowls, as well as Thomas's helmet and thigh armor, to catch enough water to keep their bellies full, which somewhat eased the pain of their hunger.
"I wish we had music," the priest said,
poking at the glowing logs with the broken end of the scythe he was nearly killed with. "I don't. You might be tempted to sing," Tomas said, inspecting his leg where the thing had hit him with her scepter. He suspected the bone of the shin was chipped. A truly ugly bruise had formed, and the flesh around his ankle was swollen and bruised as well. The damn thing had gotten him right where the horse had broken his leg at Cressy.
"Perhaps the girl will sing," the priest said. "I don't feel like it,"
she said in a nasal little mew. She was getting sick. She had no fever, but she sniffled and complained of an ache near her hips. She had been in enough cold and wet that neither man suspected her of plague.
"But what kind of music would you like to hear if you could choose?"
she asked Père Mathieu.
"Oh, a lute. Most certainly a lute. And you, Sir Knight?"
"A lute? That's court music. That's for troubadours to make wives spread their legs when their husbands are at war."
"I find it very pretty, if the player is skillful. It takes more training to master the lute, don't you agree?"
"Than what?"
"A drum, for example, or a cornemuse."
"That's what I'd like to hear. A drum and a cornemuse."
"Soldiers' music. That's for making husbands leave their wives behind for troubadours."
"Ha!" As night came on, they fell to telling stories to pass the time. The priest began, telling the story of a knight who was actually a werewolf, but a very considerate one, who removed himself into the forest to change his skin. His wife, however, betrayed him by hiding his clothes so he could not change back. In this way, her husband was thought to have disappeared, and she was able to marry her lover.
"Go on," Tomas said. "Finish it."
"It is finished."
"The hell it is."
"Is it not?"
"No, it is not. You only told half of it."
"It's all I know."
"What the hell kind of story is that? The adulterous wife wins out? The noble werewolf is deceived and banished?"
"Forgive me if I gave offence. Perhaps you should tell one now to instruct me in how these things are properly done."
"Imagine it's a sermon. A good story has a lesson. What's the lesson here? Whore's triumph?"
"I don't know," the priest said, fidgeting. "Maybe. Something about the deceiving nature of woman."
Tomas stared intently at the priest in the firelight, and it was difficult for him to tell whether Tomas was being jocular or actually growing angry.
"That explains it, then," he said. "They tell priests stories about how bad women are so they won't fuck them."
"It's hardly working. I'm the only priest I know without an acknowledged mistress in his village."
Now Tomas laughed, and the priest relaxed.
"I know how the story ends,"
the girl said.
"Oh? Father used to tell it."
"Well, let's hear it," said Tomas.
"The knight went into the woods as a beast,"
Delphine said, and here she made the sound of a beast.
"And one day the king and his hunting party found him. They were about to slay him, but then the big wolf bowed to the king."
"I like it better already," Tomas said, nudging the priest.
"Now, the king decided to make a pet of him, and he took him home to the castle. Everyone came to marvel at the beast, who was so tame and courtly, until one day the wife and the knight came. Wait, I forgot something."
"Are you sure you know this story?" the priest said, but Tomas nudged him again, a bit harder.
"Yes,"
she said gravely, looking at Père Mathieu until he held his palms up in acquiescence. She sneezed and started again.
"When the king found the beast, The knight who had married his wife was there, and the beast growled at him.
She growled and gnashed her teeth, causing both men to laugh.
They wanted to kill it, and that's when it went up and licked the king's hand. So now we are back at the castle, and when the wife and the bad knight come in, the beast bites her nose.
Delphine trailed off, and the priest knew what she was beginning to remember. So he clapped his hands twice, startling her.
The story," he said.
She nodded and blinked her tears away, wiping at them with her sleeve and snuffling.
"It bites her. He bites her. The knight."
"Yes, I think we have it."
"And they want to kill it again, but the king's wise counselor says not to."
"Where do they find these wise counselors in stories?" Tomas said. "For I've never met a king who let one speak."
"So they make the wife tell them why it bit her."
"I definitely like this version better. Whore wife bitten and tortured," Tomas said.
"And the king commands the bad knight to bring the good knight's clothes. Wait, he's wearing them, so he just takes them off."
"Now he's naked."
"I guess so, yes."
"Is it cold in this castle?"
"Of course," she said very seriously. "All castles are cold."
"Exactly how many castles have you been in?"
"I haven't been in boats, but I know they have sails."
"Ah, there's your lawyer father. I knew he'd come visit."
She sighed sharply in exasperation.
"Do you want to hear this?"
she said.
"So, we have a shivering knight with a shrinking bit."
Both of them looked reproachfully at Tomas.
"Do you want me to finish? Because I can't when you keep interrupting me to show how clever you are."
"Ooh," Tomas said. "I stand rebuked. So the naked knight?"
"They give him a robe."
"So the knight with the robe?"
"The knight is not important now."
"So the unimportant knight?"
Delphine got up and walked away, folding her arms. Both men, giggling like boys at her irritation, now implored her to come back.
"Sweet Delphine, tell us the story." "Don't take on so. The story, the story."
At length she took her place again, but pointed her small finger at Tomas. He put his hand over his mouth.
"So the king laid out the clothes for the beast, but it just sniffed them and sat down."
Tomas removed his hand and said,
"Did it?"
But she cut him off with a "st" and pointed her finger again. He replaced his hand.
"The wise counselor said that the knight was ashamed to change in front of them, so they put the beast in a bedroom with the clothes. He went in on four legs and came out on two."
They both looked at her expectantly.
"What?"
she said.
"Finish it," Tomas said.
"I did. He became a man again."
"What about the bastard knight and the whore wife? Were they killed?"
"If you like."
"What do you mean, if I like? It happened or it didn't?"
"It's just a story."
"Yes, and it has an ending."
"I told you the ending."
"But we still have loose ends."
"Fine,"
she said.
"I'll finish it to your tastes. The knight takes his sword and cuts the heads off both of them. Blood goes everywhere. Blood, blood, blood. Then he cuts the head off the king too. Bloody blood, blood. And he puts the crown on his own head, so he's king. And the wise counselor gives him his pretty daughter to marry, even though she's only 15 years old. And they have lots of babies and then die and go to heaven. How do you like that, Sir Tomas?"
He clapped his hands and hooted.
"Now that's a cunting story," he said.
I think we have a visitor,
the priest said, pointing at the barn window, where a pair of eyes peeked at them below a mane of tangled, wet hair knotted with grass. Tomas drew a log from the fire, and it hit the wall next to the window, showering sparks.
"Go on!"
he shouted, reaching for his sword, but the eyes just blinked at him. He got up, and the face disappeared. They saw the naked old man run by the door, looking wildly in at them.
"This is my barn,"
he said, outraged, and ran into the rain again. There was no question of Tomas catching him. The knight slept poorly. He woke panting in darkness from a dream about riding his horse through a field of brambles, and tried to remember where he was. When he did, he noticed that the rain had stopped, and he walked outside to look up at the sky. The half-moon flirted with him through gouges in slow-moving clouds that still held water, but he would not be able to look for his comet. He thought it might be out of sight now, having murdered its stellar swan, but he had no doubt that others had come. This had been a promiscuous summer for comets. Only it wasn't summer anymore. His breath plumed out in front of him. It was nearing mid-September, but it was cold like October. He heard movement behind him, and then a sound of mild displeasure. He turned to see the priest stooping to drink from the bowl he had set out.
"It's musty," he said. "My bowl could do with a scrubbing."
Tomas looked at the sky again.
"Couldn't sleep?"
the priest asked. Tomas didn't answer.
"I know, stupid question. Hardly worthy of William of Ockham. I should have asked if you had bad dreams.
I did.
Would you like to know what about?"
Tomas didn't speak.
"I was being led around the countryside by a little girl. There were horrid things in rivers, and statues crawled off churches, and a great sickness had killed most everybody. I was starving to boot."
Silence.
"My only other companion was a moody, excommunicate knight who rarely spoke and didn't have the slightest interest in hearing about my nightmares. And, of course, a mule."
Tomas sighed.
"I liked the mule."
"What did you really dream?"
"I dreamed my brother had no legs."
"The one in Avignon, the catamite?"
"I have only one brother. He walked about with crutches, like a stilt man, but drab and sad. I fed him from my hand as if he were a bird, but he was not grateful. He hated me for my legs."
"That sounds better than the other one. Perhaps you should go back to sleep."
Now the priest looked at the sky.
"What's up there?"
"If a priest doesn't know, how should I?"
"Huh, maybe a better priest would."
He stooped now and took rainwater from the knight's thigh piece. Tomas took a long look at Père Mathieu.
"You haven't been defrocked or anything, have you?"
"Should have been, perhaps, but no."
"You just don't always seem quite like a priest."
"Funny. I felt the same way ever since the day I took orders."
"Why did you, then?"
"Like most of the others, my father sent me."
"Why didn't you follow him into his trade?"
The priest didn't say anything.
"Well?"
"He was a soldier."
"And?"
"Do I seem like a soldier to you?"
"Not even a little."
"And yet I am heroic compared with my brother."
Tomas grunted, imagining how he might look upon his son if he proved too weak for arms. He imagined himself beating it out of him and making a man of him. It occurred to him that the priest's father had probably tried. Our father used to say, "Since God has sent me only daughters, I shall send the bearded ones to take orders, and the others to fetch back sons."
Tomas chuckled.
"Yes, I suppose it is funny," the priest said. "The first dozen times."
Tomas drank out of his helm. Thunder rumbled in the distance. "We're in for more of it," Tomas said. The priest nodded.
"May I tell you?"
"What?" Tomas said.
"What I did."
"I'd rather you didn't."
"I know."
"Then why ask?" The priest folded his arms around himself against the cold.
"I don't have anyone else to confess to."
14. Of the Stained Priest and the Widow's Revenge. 2 months before the plague came to Saint-Martin-le-Preux, Père Mathieu Anicot was in love. His hands shook as he put on his chasuble and prepared the candles and the incense, and when he preached his sermon, his left armpit ran cold with sweat, even though the mornings were still cool that May. It seemed curious to him that only the left armpit was affected. Perhaps, he thought, because the heart was supposed to sit just a little to the left. And his sin, as of this morning, was still only in his heart. The sweat would run from the moment he approached the altar. Even with his back to his flock, he thought about where the object of his affection would be standing, 3 or 4 rows back, always closest to the aisle, at the level of the stained glass window portraying the brides with their lanterns. He could even distinguish the young man's cough from the rest of his congregation. On this particular day, the object was wearing his best grey cotardie, buttoned snugly up his trunk, and standing with one leg in the aisle, which the others took for rascality, but which was in fact to better display his bright red stocking and the long, well-carved leg in it. As Père Mathieu lifted the Eucharist, he tried to keep his thoughts on the words he was pronouncing. But then he felt the cold sweat running, and knew it was making him stink. The new love sweat hit high in the nose with a sharp note like cheese or salt or metal, or the miscarriage of all three. His inner cassock was so ripe with infatuation that he sweated again when he brought it to the laundress's and blushed when he gathered it back. The boy's father was the village reeve, whose job it was to act as liaison between the farmers and their seigneur. As was often the case with reeves, Samuel Herbert was mistrusted by each side. The seigneur believed he let the villagers off too early when they worked his manor farm their customary 2 days per week. This was true, but many of the villagers believed Herbert was too scrupulous in counting and weighing the shares of livestock and harvests they owed their lord. In fact, this was not true. He often let the best cow stay with the inheritors after a peasant died, and brought a slightly less meaty one up the river as Harriet. Nonetheless, it was Samuel Herbert who took from them, and these proud Norman farmers better perceived slights than kindnesses. And, by peasant standards, he was rich. Michel Herbert, his second son, was going to Paris to study law. At 20, he would be a bit older than most of his colleagues, but a tidy bribe had been administered, and a bursar from the university had met the boy and declared him good enough in Latin that something might be made of him. Soon, Père Mathieu thought, with great sadness and resignation, those red legs would not be standing in the aisle near the window. He was right, of course, but not because the boy was going to Paris. The great death was coming. It had already begun devouring Avignon, where it was said the Pope heard audiences between 2 fires to burn off pestilential air, and nibbling at Paris, where the first afflicted households were trying to hide their sick so they would not be shunned by their neighbors.
The priest knew his congregation was hungry for news about the disease and its progress. He knew they craved some reassurance that Saint-Martin-le-Preux would be spared, whether for its holiness, or because they had suffered enough under the hand of their greedy seigneur, but he could not summon up the words. The truth was that he knew nothing. He did not know how it was spread, what had caused it, where it would go, or what could be done for the ill. What troubled him most was his feeling that God could see into his heart and knew that his love was twisted. God would weigh his most secret thoughts and, finding them repulsive, would take an even heavier toll on the villeins of his flock. He would have thrown himself into the river, but a suicide priest might be worse in God's eyes than a would-be sodomite. He had never felt so ignorant, useless, or doubtful in his life. His homily addressed the sin of wrath, and how much it displeased the Lord when neighbors bickered over the placement of fences or insults spoken in the alehouse.
"What do you think will happen in the alehouse? Will you make peace there, or will you quarrel? I tell you, a devil loves no better hiding place than a bowl of beer."
He knew as soon as he said the words that he had stepped on dangerous ground. The whole village knew him for a tippler. He had more to say about alcohol making people fight, but decided to cut that short and get on to something about angels. People liked angels. But he was too late. As he cleared his throat to buy himself a moment, his most frequent sparring partner took advantage of his slip.
"If devils hide in beer, is that why you drink so much wine?"
said Sylvain Berthier, the drover. Not everyone laughed, but enough of them so that he forced himself to smile rather than trying to rebuke the popular Berthier. A drop of that awful cold sweat ran down his left side.
"Yes, I know that I take more comfort than I should in wine. Even God's shepherds are not without sin. But which of you has seen it make me quarrelsome? Our drover here often has blacker eyes than his oxen."
He glanced at the object, who was smiling now at his skillful riposte, then cut his eyes quickly away to make it look as though he were surveying all of them. For every time he sneaked a glance at Michel Herbert, he made himself look 10 more parishioners in the face. The rest of the homily went smoothly, if blandly, until the water clock told him half an hour had gone by and he began to wrap things up. When Mass was over and he saw his congregation out, he made sure to turn his right side toward those who came to speak to him, especially Michel.
"You're a clever man,"
the younger Herbert said, and looked at Père Mathieu just long enough for him to notice the boy had a sort of black freckle in the hazel of his eye, his left eye.
"There are greater virtues,"
the priest said, wishing Michel would clasp hands with him before he turned and left. He did not. Rather, he hurried on his pretty red legs to walk beside Mélisande Arnaud, a plump girl whose pretty face, just the color of cream, turned the heads of even those who liked their women lean. He knew from the confessional that Michel had already fornicated with several girls, including his own half-sister, and fully expected Mélisande to be inventoried soon. He had also lately confessed to having impure thoughts about men. Whatever demon oversaw lust had his hooks deep in Michel Herbert, and used him now to ensnare others. If there were demons at all. "If that boy is Satan's instrument, God, show me some sign. Let him look back at me." But he wanted that backward glance so much that he couldn't bear to attach wickedness to it, so he confounded himself. "Rather, let him look back at me if there are no devils in him." The boy did look back over his shoulder at him, just once, and only for an instant, but it was enough. He would always think of it as having started that day. Each night became a battle for Mathieu Anicot. He was in danger of losing his belief, if not his soul. Were there souls at all? Was there really a naked, invisible little version of himself hiding under his skin, so valuable to heaven and hell that each would send emissaries down to fight for it? He started by telling himself he would not drink more than one cup of wine, then two, and then three, lest he should become drunk and give himself up to thinking about those red legs. In the end, his head was reeling. He was spent, dry-mouthed from spitting in his hand, and he lay in his shame and guilt until the small hours of the morning. The days were better, even though his parishioners began to ask after his health, because he had lost weight and had bags under his eyes. He was far less miserable ministering to them than lying alone with his thoughts. It was better to counsel fat, bearded Sanson Berthier to apologize to his wife for menacing her with his billhook, and to smell the farts Berthier would gravely fan away with his straw hat. It was better to walk with his box of holies out to give last rites to Clément Fougier 3 times in 1 week, only to have him get well. It was even better to be bitten by Fougier's dog on the last visit and hear the old man laugh from his sickbed. One night near the end of May, he went down to the river and walked along its banks, enjoying the pleasantly cool air and getting lost in the beauty of the sky, where the moon was veiling herself with gauzy, fast-moving clouds. She was not full, but she was bright enough to illuminate the river, sending cloud shadows racing over the water and the willows near this part of the bank. It was near one of these willows that a bright swath of moonlight dragged itself over a set of cast-aside clothes. Père Mathieu could not resist peeking at the river, where he was sure he would spy a bather. He was not disappointed. In fact, there were two of them, and much closer than the clothes. Seeing him, a girl inexpertly stifled a squeal, then thrashed out of the water, covering her breasts and running for her homespun dress. She was plump and pale. God help him, it was Mélisande. He knew who was in the river. The girl picked up her clothes and ran to where the trees got thicker before dressing and loping home. The other made no effort to run. He did not even leave the river. Rather, he just crouched to hide all but his head and languidly oared the water around him with his arms. He was looking directly at the priest, who stood there for a long moment, torn between turning and walking home and trying to find something to say. Nothing occurred to him. He could not see the freckle in the boy's eye, but he imagined it. He imagined more than that. Cloud shadows moved across the water, now darkening the lad's head, now letting the moon paint it silver. "Come in," the boy said, so quietly that Père Mathieu convinced himself he had not heard it. He just opened his mouth and closed it again, like a landed fish trying to breathe. "Come in," the object of his affection said again. "I can't." "Père Mathieu can't." "No." "So shed him with your clothes, and put him back on when you leave." "No." "That's the beauty of being nude in a river. You're nobody. You're anybody you want to be. It's just a dream." "You used the same words to get the girl in there." The priest opened and closed his mouth. "Come in," the boy said again. And he did. The great death got close in June, and the bridge leading to Paris was burned on the seigneur's command. Little groups of armed farmers hid in the woods and frightened off those coming overland from the other side. They soon found that the days off from farm labor were to their liking. They also found that, with no wives to nag them, they could drink all the beer and cider they cared to. They fashioned masks of river reeds and clay, raven's feathers, and the teeth of foxes to make themselves terrifying, and also to remind them not to look anyone in the eyes. It was widely believed that the plague leapt from one man to another by means of a deadly beam from the eyes. They called themselves the Brotherhood of Saint-Martin's Arse. They drank themselves into such a state of belligerence that even groups of strangers who agreed to turn around found themselves cudgelled so they would remember not to try again. It was not long before they carried their antics back with them into town. Elise Planchette, the widow who ran the alehouse, soon learned to hate the hooting and boasts that announced the Brotherhood's return from patrol. Shutting the door was no good. They would keep at her until she opened it. Then expect their drinks for free for their solemn work guarding the town from pestilence. Nearly every day they could be seen at the widow's tables, dicing and carousing with their masks tipped back. Those who watched by day came in the evening. Those who watched in the evening came by day. Their farms suffered as their wives and fathers took up the manuring and the weeding and the harrowing, but the men of the Brotherhood had grown so fond of their newfound status as militiamen that there was no reasoning with them. The reeve could not make them work. The priest could not turn them away from their folly. Their number did shrink as some men, like Sanson Berthier, dropped out, but it grew again as bullies saw a way out of work. When one of them stole wood from the widow's house, saying his duties left him no time for chopping, she tried to block his way out, but found herself pushed down on her backside. She complained to the herald. This herald promised to take the matter before their lord, but nothing was done. The seigneur, terrified of plague, had suspended court sessions and shut himself away with his retinue. Only the herald was seen, arching his painted eyebrows and reading unenforceable proclamations from the back of his palfrey. Men-at-arms could be seen walking the parapet of the keep, their armor winking in the early summer light. But they never came down any more. The Brotherhood of Saint-Martin's Arse was all the justice there was in Saint-Martin-le-Preux. One night, when there was enough moon, several of the day watch went drunkenly to the river to gather reeds for new members to make masks with. Steering for a growth of reeds near the charred and collapsed timber of the bridge, one of them noticed a pair of red stockings balled up on the shore. Other clothes were concealed nearby.
"Look here, boys," he whispered. "We've got some June frolics in the river."
"Ho!"
one of them cried, slapping the water with his staff.
"Come out, little fishes. One of you can show us her gills."
They guffawed at that and began whistling, but no head broke the water.
"Under there,"
one said, pointing at where the western ruin of the bridge still stood. They waded in the mud and looked underneath. There, hiding by the pilings, shivered a very pale and naked priest, holding the hands of the reeve's son, who was also in the state of Adam. Both of them were slicked with mud halfway up their shins.
"I don't believe my whoring eyes," the one man said.
Now the boy panicked and sloshed out toward the other side of the bridge, running when he got to the bank. Père Mathieu nearly followed him, but then lost all hope. He turned his back to the men, held his face in his hands, and cried. He was sure they would kill him. None of them moved for a long moment. Then one of them spat on him. Then another. When all of them had done so, they turned, laughing, and walked back up the river and into town to spread the news. So it was that when the plague came, only a dozen souls were coming to Mass. Père Mathieu's assistant and bell-ringer, a stocky, busy, black-haired child everyone called Bourdon, performed his duties without his former energy. Hardly any received the priest when he came to anoint their loved ones in death. Only a handful sought confession. Soon the Reeve's son died, and the Reeve, and nearly the whole village. Heartbroken, yet afraid for his life, the priest stopped going to church at all, shutting himself up in his house with his wine. It was not until the monster moved into the river that the villagers sought their shepherd out and shamed him into helping them. There was no one else they could go to. So he tried. He went house to house seeking men who could use a weapon. When he saw how strong the thing was and knew he did not have enough healthy men to fight it, he took up the place where the Brotherhood used to wait and sat with his lantern, praying for soldiers to come down the road. As it turned out, one did. As for the Brotherhood of Saint-Martin's Arse, they were already gone. They were, in fact, among the first victims. The widow fell ill, having caught it from the farmer's child who helped her clear up, and the surgeon had refused to see her. Trying to do for herself what she believed he would have done for her, she bled herself into a wooden bowl, though this only made her weaker. The lump in her groin was so painful that it was all she could do to drag herself down the stairs and to the alehouse door when, after one of her bleedings, the Brotherhood pounded at it. They wore their masks. They stank of drink and were demanding more. She told them to go away because she was tired. They insisted. She told them to go away for the love of God. They said they had none. So she served them. If they tasted the blood mixed into their beer, they never said a word about it. 15. Of the Visitation in the Barn.
So I damned half my village. My weakness made them hate me, so they stayed away from Mass. They were cut off from the sacraments.
Thomas furrowed his brow at the priest.
But it doesn't make sense. As you said yourself, most priests have a mistress. Why would they hate you so for dallying with the girl?
The priest shook his head and looked at the sky.
Why would the boy run off and leave the girl in the river with you? And why would she want a knobby old priest, twice her age, when she could have a handsome lad who was going to be a lawyer?
The mysteries of the heart are unknowable.
And the way you described his legs.
It was the boy who stayed in the river, wasn't it? Not the girl at all.
You kept saying, the object of my affection, because you plumbed the boy.
No,
the priest lied.
What good is confession if you lie?
Everyone lies at confession, around the edges at least. A man who fornicates with his brother's wife will say it was a whore.
A woman will say she was glad in her heart that her blind and deaf baby died, when what she means is that she drowned it.
But I wasn't lying, because a man of war like you cannot travel with a known sodomite.
You're goddamned right, Thomas said.
You need the object of my affection to have been the girl.
Yes.
So it was the girl.
Good. I hope you fucked her right in half.
The priest smiled sadly and kept looking at the sky, though the moon was gone again, covered over with clouds. Thomas drank another swig of rainwater and went inside, mildly fuming.
I wouldn't leave you,
a small voice said. The priest looked down and saw that Delphine had come from the barn.
If it was the boy,
she continued,
I wouldn't leave.
He smiled at her and wiped at his eye with the back of his hand. Then the rain came again, and they all tried to sleep. In the loft above the barn, a mouse had just peeled herself away from nursing her litter. She left them in the nest and went through a tunnel in the rotten hay, sensing that the rain had driven hosts of little bugs from the sodden ground and into the structure. It was the perfect time to hunt. Ants or grubs would make better milk than grain, and there hadn't been grain in this barn since before she birthed. As she got to the end of the tunnel, She stopped before she crossed the plain of planks that led to the beam she would skitter down to forage in the barn. She poked her nose into the air and sniffed. This was where an owl could most easily kill her, as one had taken her mate on the path between the barn and the house. She smelled something, but it was no owl. Something landed wetly on the roof, no heavier than a branch full of wet leaves, but that wasn't what it was. She looked up, then froze. It came through the straw thatching on the roof, forcing its way between the fibers, at once liquid and not liquid. She had never seen tentacles, but that was what it was. A mass of tentacles that knotted on itself again and again to move. It had no head at all. To her, it looked like a nest of snakes' tails. She was too afraid to move back into the tunnel, even when it dropped onto the planks not 2 yards from her. It writhed nearer, rearing up several of its tail arms to regard her, but then, thankfully, decided she was not what it was looking for. It collapsed on itself and went liquid again, blacker than blood, so black it was less like a stain and more like the most profound absence of light. It oozed through the spaces between the planks and disappeared. She had never given any thought to the people sleeping below her, but she knew this knot owl, this snake knot, was after them. She went back into the tunnel and burrowed in with her blind young ones, shivering so hard they moved away from her. Thomas dreamed. He was walking across a burning landscape of dry grass and nettles, and sand that shifted in the hot wind and stung his eyes. He was wearing armor. The sun seemed to hang closer to the earth than it should have. It seemed to press on his armor as if it had hands, heating the links of his mail unbearably. Smoke began to fill the air. Fires at the horizon line twinkled as figures moved near them, fanning the flames. He had heard that the infidels, under Saladin, had burned the grass at the horns of Hattin to drive the crusaders mad with thirst before he crushed them in battle, driving them out of the Holy Land, and Thomas thought that was where he was, near Jerusalem, in the Levant. The figures working the fires didn't look like people, though. Not even Muslims.
"God damn it, stop that!" he tried to shout,
but the words caught in his throat as if they had hooks. His throat was unbearably dry, and he knew he might die of thirst. It was the figures who were doing this to him. If he could reach them and kill them, it would stop. But they were so very far away, and his sword was so rusted it looked as though it would break if it struck anything hard. He clenched his teeth and moved forward, but then one of his teeth broke. He pulled a mailed glove off and pulled the tooth out. The action of doing this dislodged another one, so it wobbled in his gums, then another. Soon his whole mouth was full of loose teeth, as dry and fragile as kindling. He opened his mouth to try to get some air in it, but then he realized that was a mistake. Almost as soon as the idea came to him that the sun was so hot it might light his teeth on fire, it did exactly that. They smoldered painfully in his gums, even after he shut his mouth, and he looked around for anything at all that might give him relief. That was when he saw the thorn bush. It was about as high as his ribs, with long, wicked thorns. The whole bush seemed to bend around something at its center. A pear. But not just any pear. This was the fattest, sweetest-looking pear he had ever seen, with a leaf on its stem of impossible greenness. He knew that it was so full of watery nectar that one bite would not just ease his pain, but strengthen his limbs so he could set about the business of killing the shadowy fire-makers on the horizon. He put his glove back on against the thorns and knelt down before the bush, picking gently at the needled twigs encasing the fruit. How like ribs around a heart they were. He had to be delicate so he didn't rupture the pair. But this was hard. The thorns were so long and slender they slid deeply into his fingers, even through the links of his mail. He had to make the thorn bush want to yield the pair. So he tried to say, "Please," but all that came through his ruined mouth was a grunt. Smoke came from his nose. The arrowhead was lodged in his tongue again. He couldn't speak. He would never speak. He would never be understood by anyone or anything again. He jerked more roughly at the branches, but they pulled back. "Rip it open. Use your strength. Destroy it and eat the pulp. You can't know how sweet it is." Lies. He was being lied to. He understood at once that this pear was cousin to the fruit that ruined man in the Garden of Eden, and it would ruin him too. If he ate it, he would march to the horizon, but he would not fight the fire makers. He would become one of them, forever. He had to pull himself away from it and then move toward the horizon. He had to fight them. It was a miserable thing to leave that sweetness behind, but he did it. He got up on his leaden legs and marched toward the fire. He coughed a huge gout of stinging smoke from his mouth and nostrils into his eyes, sending him to his knees. That was when he sneezed a horrific sneeze that ejected smoke, snot, and blood all at once. He even thought some of his brain came out of his nose. Something definitely came out of his nose, and maybe his ears as well. And then he realized he was kneeling not in a hot and dry grassland, but somewhere cold, dark, and damp. The barn. With the rain on the roof and thunder growling outside. Something ran across his lap, something oily and dark.
"Die with her, then, you limp, weak prick."
And it rained itself upward somehow through the planks of the loft above them. It had left smears on his white thighs. Or was that blood? His breeches were down and his verge was half erect. Delphine was in front of him, and he was holding her arms so tightly he must have been close to breaking her delicate bones. He loosened his grip, but still held her, trying to understand. She was naked.
"Oh, Christ, Christ, no," he moaned helplessly.
She shook her head.
"You didn't," she said. "You stopped. It tried to make you, and you could have, but you stopped."
He blinked dumbly at her dark outline with the sound of the rain dripping. The priest snored. She managed to smile through her quiet sobbing. He let her arms go and she put her gown back on. He pulled his breeches up, still staring at her, peripherally aware that his hands hurt. When they were both clothed again, she hugged him and cried warm tears onto his neck. He patted her sides and shoulders awkwardly.
"You beat it,"
she said, her lean body hitching with sobs.
"You won."
He saw that her gown was bloody, but then realized it was his blood. His hands were bleeding freely where they had been stuck with thorns. In the morning, Delphine woke again to find that not all the blood on her gown was from Tomas's hands, which she knew had been injured. Tomas was at the other end of the barn, with the mule's leg between his, scraping mud and rocks from its shoe. How like him to defy his pain by doing something to make it worse. Her belly hurt, and her thighs were slick with blood. At first, she feared that she might have been wrong and that he might have violated her in the night, but this was only for an instant. The dream had seemed like other true dreams. She had dreamed that Tomas had a black crab in his head that was driving him as a man drives a cart, and this crab wanted him to hurt her. She had awakened in the darkness to find him undressing her, delicately at first, but then roughly, his eyes far away. But as she tried to pull away from him, he sneezed violently and something came out of him. He had pushed it out of him. Besides, the pain was in her belly, not where it would have been had she been taken. No, the blood was not from the loss of her maidenhead. Sometime in the night, she had become a woman. She would have liked to speak to her mother about this, or to Annette. As soon as she remembered these two vacancies in her heart, she braced herself for sadness to overwhelm her. Instead, she imagined Père Mathieu trying to advise her on these matters, and the thought struck her so funny that she giggled. Her giggling turned to laughter, and even though she cupped her hand over her mouth, she woke the priest.
"My, but you're in a good mood this morning," he said.
But then he caught sight of the blood and turned the corners of his mouth down, saying,
"Sweet heavens!"
which seemed such a ridiculous oath to attach to the mess in her lap that she laughed even harder.
"What's so funny?"
Thomas said, still scraping. The mule looked over, too. The priest went and washed his hands in rainwater, even though he had not touched her, stammering a moment before he found his voice.
"Well, it seems our kitten is a cat."
16. Of the Maple Tree. Delphine was too restless to sit in the cart, so she walked alongside while the two older men rode. The clothes she had bundled around her middle were coarse and chafed her, but she was glad to have found them in the farmhouse. The mother of the dead family inside had been halfway through sewing a dress for herself when the disease came and made her lay her needle aside. She had been found leaning out the window, dead a good month, so she was mostly bone, the wattle under her dark as though she had melted into the wall. Delphine thought the woman's fever might have made her want air at the end of it. She guessed, too, that the whole family had sickened at once. One small corpse hugged another in the corner opposite, the smaller of them clutching a cloth poppet with eyes of snail shell. The mother was already too weak to bury them when they died. And where was the man of the house? Was it the old man in the barn? Or was he the woman's father? She guessed it was the father, and that he had been mad before and they kept him in the barn. But then it occurred to her that he might have hidden himself there to save his life, perhaps warning others away with that rusty scythe, and there lost his mind. And the husband? Was he dead before the plague came, in the war perhaps, or had he run off to save himself? She knew many such stories of betrayal and selfishness from her village, though she also knew stories of great faithfulness and courage. The pestilence cooked away pretense and showed people's souls, as surely as it eventually showed their bones.
"What are you thinking about over there?"
Thomas said. Ever since the incident in the barn, he had been kinder to her. She wondered how long it would last.
"Death,"
she said.
"That's cheerful. Perhaps you'd like to sing us a song about it?"
She ignored this.
"No singing? Maybe you'll dance us a merry brawl then. The priest and I grow bored with watching this mule's ass sway."
She wrinkled her mouth, trying not to encourage his vulgarity by smiling at it. Instead, she bent down for a mud clot and threw it, though it sailed well behind and landed in the cart.
"Ha!" he laughed at her. "Now that you're a woman, you can't do things boys can do, can you? A boy would have pelted me right between the eyes."
She snarled at him and walked faster, cutting in front of the mule.
"Now I will watch the mule's ass and he will watch yours. Is that your remedy?"
She walked faster, letting herself smile now that the coarse knight would not have the satisfaction of seeing it. The priest knew something had transpired between the knight and the girl, but the nature of the change puzzled him. if Tomas had forced himself upon her, would she still go with them? To keep herself alive, perhaps, but surely she would not jest and smile so much. What if she had allowed him, or had gone to him? She was the right age to start thinking of such things, after all, now that she bore the mark of Eve. If that were the case, surely he would see it in a thoughtless caress or in a too long glance. They did look at each other more, but almost as a father and daughter might, where the father had picked the child as his favorite and teased her playfully. It did not seem carnal. He had taught himself to divine when his parishioners were fornicating, so he could better coax them to lighten their souls with confession. But who was he to judge anyone or propose any remedy for sin? He was such a profound sinner that he had considered leaving off his robes and stopping the pretense. He was just an old bugger who would sell his last possession for a barrel of good wine, or any wine. And he was lonely. The most puzzling thing for him was his own reaction to the newfound, though seemingly platonic, intimacy between his companions. Père Mathieu was jealous. On their fifth day since Paris, they camped near a swollen stream, up on a rocky bank that gave them a decent view of the country around them. Tomas and the priest sharpened long sticks to use as spears, and spent the last hours of daylight trying to gig fish in the river. They got only one, and a small one. The frogs they had hunted eluded them easily, sheltering between rocks or hopping into thick river grass, and now mocked them with their buzzing evensong farther down the stream. The girl went to forage in the woods. She returned at twilight with a rusty, hole-ridden pot, in which she carried two handfuls of acorns, several walnuts, and a broken horseshoe. "God damn it," Tomas said, gazing at her small cache.
"Maybe God would be more generous if you swore less."
"God starves babies sometimes, and they don't swear at all."
Having no answer for that, Delphine found a tree stump and began pounding acorns with the horseshoe. They would make an awful, mouth-puckering companion to the two mouthfuls of trout they could each look forward to, but it would be marginally better than nothing.
"Babies go straight to heaven," she said now.
Tomas didn't look up from his work setting river stones to make a fire.
"Bad ones don't," he said.
"There are no bad babies," she said. "They don't know any better."
"Sounds like you've never met a baby. Many of them are awful. I knew one in Picardy who stole his father's money and crawled down the road to the whorehouse."
"It was you," she said. "The only bad baby ever was you."
The priest sighed and went off to gather more sticks for the fire. They ate their awful dinner, sucking each slender bone and washing the bitter acorn meal down with water. The walnuts were last, least, and best. Stomachs still rumbling, they each settled down, the men near the cart, the girl with her head against the tree stump. The only sounds were the stream, the frogs, and the mule munching his fill of grass. In the morning, as the men stirred, Delphine woke up at dawn, but the exhausted men slept later. She amused herself first by collecting river pebbles in her gathered gown front, and then sowing them as a farmer would with an apron full of seeds. When she was out of pebbles, she took up one of the fishing spears and, holding it butt end down, pretended to stir the rusty pot. The priest sat up, stiff from his night on the rocky ground, and noticed her at her game.
"What are you cooking for us, daughter?" he said.
"A stew."
"Christ, don't start that," Tomas said.
"What kind of stew?"
the priest asked, secretly happy to needle the knight's hunger.
"Cabbages and pepper."
"Real pepper?" the priest said. "Will the king be joining us?"
"Yes," she said,
and all his ministers. But I wasn't done with the stew.
Christ, drowning in shit, Tomas said, putting his straw hat over his face.
Mushrooms and turnips and even pork belly.
And shit, Tomas grumbled from his hat. Don't forget the shit.
What a lovely meal, the priest said. May I have some?
Delphine nodded gravely, still stirring. The priest got up and held his wooden bowl out so she could pretend to fill it with her stick ladle. He slurped air from a pretend spoon and said,
My compliments, it's perfect.
Tomas peeked from under the hat to confirm what he thought he was hearing. Then he replaced the hat, saying, Jesus wept. Just before they left their camp, the priest found another walnut, which had escaped through a hole in the girl's gathering pot. He found the broken horseshoe and looked around for the stump, but couldn't find it. Thinking nothing of it, he opened the nut against the cart and brought it to Delphine, who did her best to take exactly 1/3 of it. He shared the rest with Tomas, who said, How can you stuff yourself so? Aren't you full of shit and cabbage stew? They climbed wearily into the cart and left. None of them noticed that the maple stump against which Delphine had slept had grown into a tree.